Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of FinTech Mavericks. I'm your host, Nicole Casperson.
And I'm Drew Glover. Nicole, before we start today's episode, I was thinking, we hear all our Maverick guests talk about how important telling your story is. But in meeting after meeting, I keep finding out that so many founders aren't actually doing it.
Well, we all know why, Drew. No one has the time or the bandwidth.
1000%, which is why I love working with Brex. It simplifies your financial back office so you actually get your time back.
But how can we make sure all of our Maverick listeners have the go-to business account, card, bill pay, and travel all handled?
I've got it. All right, listeners, Nicole and I have partnered up with our friends at Brex to bring you something special because you too deserve to spend smarter and move faster.
Here's the deal. Open a Brex business account to enjoy $750 in Brex travel credits or $450 cash back just for signing up.
And if you're a remote company, the perks get even better, not to mention all the add-ons from AWS to OpenAI and more.
Want to actually free up your calendar and focus on building? Go to brex.com/fintechmavericks and learn how you too can spend smarter.
And move faster.
With Brex.
With Brex.
Today's guest is someone who has shaped the way modern fintech and modern works and scales from zero to something that the world cannot ignore. Basically, our guest today is very good at picking winners, and she's going to teach us how to do that ourselves. From building Stripe's earliest partnerships to leading platform growth at Notion to helping define the next era of work at Linear as COO, she is an absolute force. Christina Cordova, welcome to FinTech Mavericks.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so excited for you to be here. So Christina, diving a little into your origin story, if you will, how one becomes a FinTech Maverick. You've said in past interviews that you knew early on that you didn't want to be a lawyer. We have that in common, by the way. My mom really wanted me to be a lawyer, and I was like, no.
I think all parents wanted their kids to be lawyers, by the way.
So I have that in common with the rest of the world, right? Okay, good. Yeah, it's like doctor, lawyer. Anyways,
right.
Didn't want to do either of those. But you knew that, or you kind of learned over the years that working in tech was the first time that you really felt like things were moving as fast as you did. What was the moment that made you realize that you kind of found your lane in fintech?
Yeah. I felt actually the way that it really started was just starting to kind of like observe other people in their roles and the jobs that they had. I mean, I didn't grow up with anyone who spent time in like technology or finance or any of these things. So I think one question is like, how do you get exposed to these things without actually having them around early on in life? And I was very fortunate to have a friend of mine who was working at a gaming startup, actually. And there she was telling me about like how her internship was going and telling me about all the cool stuff that she got to work on. And I was like, they let an intern work on that? Like, it was like crazy that they would let you, person who knows you know, nothing, no experience, like work on this kind of stuff. And it turned out she was going to study abroad the next quarter. And she was like, well, hey, it seems like you kind of are like interested in what I'm working on. Like, do you want to come in and like fill in for me? Because I'm going to leave. And I was like, I would love that. And it turns out I was basically saying yes to like an unpaid, you know, internship.
Oh. No.
During my like senior year of college. So I ended up giving up a full, like a paid job that I had during the school year to take this like unpaid tech internship because I knew that it was going to be really hard otherwise for me to like find a job. And this was also 2009. So I had a bunch of friends actually who had like had like iBanking offers and stuff like that that were rescinded because this was like the financial crisis and things like that. So, you know, my mom at the time was like, people are going to be beating down your door to give you a job offer. Like, you went to Stanford. And I was like, this does not seem like the
what's vibe, actually happening.
You know, yeah. Doesn't seem like the vibe that's happening here. And so, you know, for me, I just wanted to work on something that I thought was like fun and interesting. And I found that actually in like traditional career paths, so like legal or maybe like a traditional business path, I feel it would felt very much like kind of like pushing paper, like moving things along, like not really like accelerating. And so when I actually started working at a startup for the first time, I remember they were like, hey, we're starting to think about doing these like in-app ads. And so we want to pitch Warner Brothers. Can you like build the pitch deck? And I was like, me? Like, what is this going to look like? So I start working with the designer on like, you know, mocking up what it might look like so that we can make the pitch. And, you know, of course, I wasn't the one actually making the pitch. I was making the deck and then someone else was going to go make the pitch. But we ended up getting the deal. And it was the first time I was like, oh, wow, that's like so exciting to be able to feel like I had like a role in that. Again, knowing that I had like absolutely like no experience. So for me, that was kind of the first time where I was like, huh, like maybe this kind of tech thing is interesting. And I associated it with tech, realized much later, actually, as I went into like big tech, that it was not tech, that this was like startups very specifically. I didn't kind of realize that at the time, but, I ended up taking a full-time job offer to go to Google, after this like startup experience and was like, oh, wow, I'm back to like, you know, pushing paper, basically.
Yeah, right. It was almost like being a lawyer again. And well, while you were at Google, right, you had to make that that call to mom, which I think we all have, maybe most of us have felt that experience. I know I've made the call to mom saying, you know, you're not going to stay at Google. You're going to, you know, do your own thing, right, or go to the next thing, which is really about not taking the safe path, right? Like what did, I guess, leaving Google teach you about like trusting your gut?
Yeah. Well, I think like, if I'm going to be honest, like I think you can make very different career decisions and like take risks depending on like what your environment and like what your safety net is, right? And so I didn't have a safety net. You know, like I was paying like rent in an apartment, and like if I didn't have a job, like, you know, I couldn't do that, right? It's not like I could just be like, oh, like go home to mom or something like that and stay there. Right. Or maybe I could have, but God, I really did not want to. So like,
no,
right?
No.
It's just like, no, like I'm an adult, like I have an apartment, I'm going to pay my rent, we're going to do these things, right? And so it's not as if I left Google and like started looking for a job, right? I had a job like lined up, ready to go. And there was like a startup that I had been kind of helping out on the side. And they were like, we really would like you to come join us full time. And so I literally like quit my job at Google, drove out of the parking lot at like 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and then like drove into the parking lot of the startup office, you know, and started work on like Friday afternoon, right? And so, you know, for me, like I wasn't able to take the risk of being able to be like, oh yeah, like I'll have a job. I won't have a job for a period of time. Like I needed to have a job. And so for me, it was about like, well, how can I set myself up for opportunities and start to explore things in startups without necessarily having to like leave a, you know, a full-time job, which I still needed to like, you know, pay the bills. So, you know, I think the great thing about working in startups in particular is that people are very open to like having conversations with people and, you know, getting a coffee and like people are very freely giving of their time in a way that like doesn't necessarily exist in other industries. And I think a lot of that's because this industry in particular is like built on like the backs of young people, like people who are willing to like go and, you know, start a job at 4 p.m. on a Friday and just like work their butts off like crazy. And a lot of those people are the people who are going to build like generational companies, you know, at the ages of like 22. And so people are far more willing to like help out people who are earlier on in their careers with like conversations and talks and introductions that can help you get that next opportunity, far more so than like any other industry that I've seen. So like the great thing I think as a young person is that you can take advantage of that to help, you know, make your way into this industry for the first time.
Absolutely love that. I will say one thing that you've had a really good nose for really incredible companies that throughout your entire career, or, you know, up till now, knock on wood, let's keep it going here. But,
whoa.
Yeah. But I think it's really interesting that you were able to, I mean, you joined some companies when they were so early that you weren't really following a lot of people. A lot of times earlier, younger folks will say, hey, like 10 of my friends went here, therefore I'm following here. I feel like you jumped at an early stage before the rest of the world had conviction. How were you building your conviction in some of the companies that you were joining at their earliest stages?
Yeah. So the first startup that I joined full time was Pulse. That was the one right after Google.
Yep.
And you know, actually the CEO and founder of that company was a TA of mine in my class at Stanford. So he was like a master student, and he ended up building the app that was Pulse, like in a like design school class at Stanford. So I was able to kind of see things from being there, and then, you know, again, like started to kind of help him out on the side without it being like a formal role, and, you know, kind of built up that trust over time. But then I also got to like observe them, right? Understand like, how do they operate the company? How are they building this, right? Because it also wasn't started as a traditional company. It kind of was a class project effectively that like started doing really well and then became a company. And so, you know, you're able to see like, well, what does doing well look like? And in this case, this was a consumer like media app. And it started at the time when like the iPad had just come out. And so it was like one of the top apps in the app store. So you're like, oh, I see a chart. We're at number one. Like, that's very exciting. You know, we were doing so well that the New York Times like sent us a cease and desist order to try and like get us to take the app down. And then we turned that into like a press story. And so like, by all accounts, there were like enough signals that you could see like, okay, people really love this product. They're willing to pay for it. Thousands of them, right? We had revenue before we ever had any like venture capital funding, right? So like those were the signs to me that like there's something here, and there's enough that they could probably pay me for like a year or two, basically, was kind of my sense. And that the company was probably doing well enough that like some investor would give the company money. But, you know, I didn't really have a sense of like for why and what amounts and, you know, how that whole thing worked in terms of venture capital. So, you know, at that point, I was just judging based off of like, I'm a consumer. This is a consumer product. I can tell that people love this product. And, you know, these founders are people that I want to like work with. And so I thought it like at the beginning was like relatively straightforward, right? That wasn't like overly complex. And then when I was at Pulse, I ended up meeting Patrick Collison, the CEO of Stripe, at a barbecue, and ended up realizing that he was like living in the house that was right next to the Pulse office. So every morning he would hear us like on calls and stuff like that. And he'd be like, you guys are so loud in the morning. And it turns out it's because he's like coding until like 3 or 4 in the morning and like sleeping in. And, you know, wasn't like maybe perhaps working a normal schedule because it was very early days. And so got to know him over the course of months. You know, eventually they, you know, recruited me to join the company. But I think in both of these situations, you look at them and you kind of realize like, I actually had the opportunity to take my time. You know, for one founder, I was working for free. For the Stripe founders, I was getting to know them over like a longer period of time, just purely because of like proximity. And I wasn't really in like a formal, typical like job interview process, right? So I think that really helps in terms of trying to get to know people, because like startups are purely like a people decision. Are these like people who are truly amazing at what they do? And one of the things that really impressed me, I think, with the Stripe founders was that they were just so like versatile. Like they flew planes and they had like books piled up to the ceilings. And I was like, how do you have time to read these things? Aren't you like working at a on your startup. We're also just like incredibly good at like building products. And the way that I observed it for Stripe was that Stripe is a very different product, right? Financial product, but built for like early stage startups and developers at the beginning, right? So how do you find out, like, is this product resonating with its earliest customers? Like, does this product have product market fit? So I went to like Hacker News, you know, a site that I would look at just for like startup news and stuff like that. And, you know, searched Stripe.com at the time, found a bunch of like blog posts and things like that. And it seemed like Stripe was kind of really taking off with people in that particular community. So all of these were like super tiny companies. But you look at that and you're kind of like, okay, like it seems like people, at least these people, really love this product. So that's kind of interesting. And when I would talk to like developers that I knew who, had like implemented a payment system before, they would talk about like how awful it was. You'd get this like PDF documentation that you'd have to go through and how like the alternative of what Stripe was building was so much better. So then I started to kind of understand it and I started to like read through API docs and things like that, things that I had never done before. And I was like, oh, these are kind of like human readable. Like I'm not an engineer by training, but I can understand how these things work. So that's like intuitive to me, right? So to me, it was really about like people, like these people clearly like smart and talented. And then second, like there's clearly some semblance of like product market fit here. And then you just have to figure out like, can you parlay this like early version of product market fit into a business that scales? And the thing that I probably didn't think as much about, but was really like a factor I think about now, when I think about picking companies, it's that Stripe was a huge market. So initially you kind of come up with like a narrow wedge. The wedge was like, no one's paying attention to developers and what developers care about with payments and in fintech. So let's build for that audience very specifically, and we'll be the best at that. And then over time you realize that like, actually developers are a really big market and also so is payments. So, you know, the overlap of these things is actually really powerful. And so that was kind of, you know, the unique thing that makes this a, you know, multi-billion-dollar company ultimately. You know, everyone obviously gets to take part in the success of that. So, you know, to me, it's like team, and it's market. And those are like the two things, that factor into it. And then, you know, depending on how early you are, you could be so early that a product could be like, you know, pre-launch. So you have no indication of like, do people like this or not, right? But I've actually never joined a company that has been pre-launched before. So every single company I've joined has had customers, has been out in the world. And, you know, I've never joined a company past like 40 employees. So, you know, you can still join a lot of like really early stage companies that have some traction in the market that's visible. And you can try to understand, like, is that something that can continue to grow? Because also product market fit is a process that like takes time. And you start with like one part of the market and you have product market fit there. Then you start growing to the next part of the market and so on.
Yeah, I think that's such an important piece though of the story, right? Which is like all of the things that you said, but in a summary also you would take, it was a culture thing as well, right? You're like, okay, I'm here early on. I see we have like, you know, the product market fit, we have the traction, but then I love like the part that was standing out to me was you doing like a Google search, right? Or like,
yeah,
seeing how people are reacting to this, being a real observer of how our clients are reacting. How is the customer? How is like even that early on? And then deciding kind of for yourself, like, okay, this is definitely something I want to be here for the long run. I do think that's an important thing to pull out because fast forward to 2025 to today, I think there's a lot of folks who want to enter the industry or want to be in big tech and think that they just have to go to the fangs, right? Like they just have to go to these certain big names or these certain places and think that that's going to be the best thing for their career. And that can be, but there is this other side. As someone who also has only been a part, I've never worked for a Google, never worked for a big company. I've only, before becoming an entrepreneur, only worked at small, like everyone does everything publications. But wow, how fast it's made me grow, right? How quickly I got to move forward. Now, you know, I'm a 31-year-old CEO, right? Like, it just, that is something that's kind of standing out to me, is just the like quickness in which you can move if you're willing to go that route. Mm-hmm. But you have to be willing to go that route.
Yeah. Yeah. And the companies are small enough where it's not even just about your individual learning anymore, right? Like what you're learning by what you're doing every day. But there were so many like talented people that I worked with over the years where I was close enough to observe how they did what they did, right? Like, oh, how do you do this kind of marketing, or how do you do these kinds of things? And even though I never had a formal marketing job, or I never had like, you know, formally run these functions, it's like, well, I know what good looks like because I've seen it. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Even though I haven't done it. Right. And so, you know, what are the lessons that you kind of take away from that you can kind of carry on to like the next opportunity?
And
yeah, no, I love that. Can we, sorry, go ahead, Drew. I'm still stuck on the part where you met the founder of Stripe at a barbecue.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Drew, just hold on to your question, Drew, in case it wasn't, if it wasn't about Stripe, because can we learn more about that? Just because I feel like that was a secret gem that you just dropped, and I need to know more. So like, you meet him at a barbecue.
Yes.
Then what?
Yes. So importantly, the barbecue was actually hosted by Yuri Sagalov, who's an investor now at General Catalyst, but at the time was a YC startup founder. And so he invited a bunch of people who were YC startup founders and, you know, other people at startups to this barbecue. So, you know, this was also in an era where like it was Palo Alto, a lot of startups were there at the time. A lot of people were just like hanging out with other startup people, right? So also like a lot of it is just hanging out with other people who are building things.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's like kind of part of like making some of these connections and building those connections over time. And, you know, that's how you see companies like early stage companies get acquired by other companies and go on to do great things. You know, like a lot of this is happening just because of those relationships that you build over time.
And I just want to point that out because it is important to be willing to want to build those relationships and take that time, right? Like if you didn't show up to the barbecue and was willing to do the networking and like willing to talk to this, you know, person that you don't know is going to be this huge thing until later on. Right.
Right.
But I do think that that element is important because in today's world, and especially in today's like content driven world, I think we focus way too much on like people that have already
made it
when, when we should be the ones deciding who is the next big thing. Like that's even more exciting, is deciding, I'm betting on that winning horse like you've done. I'm sorry, Drew. I couldn't get away from.
It's a good call out. Go ahead, Christina.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just like, what are the things you notice about those people in those conversations, right? Like things I noticed from those conversations, and like, what do you take away from them? Like Patrick Collison, and this was true even when I was at Stripe, would use words that like I had to look up in the dictionary. Like I was like, what is that word?
Nope, been there
later. So you know, things like that where you're just like, this is like really interesting. And then just like so many like diverse interests and like incredibly bright, very obvious, right? Like anyone who would meet him and have like a substantive conversation with him would like be able to tell that like very quickly, right? And this is the kind of industry where like that's something that you pay attention to, right? I was actually talking to some people who had I was like meeting some of the people from Figma early on, and someone was like, oh, have you met Evan from Figma? He's a genius. And so you're like, oh. Like if someone I think is really, really smart is telling me that about this like founder, like that's probably true. That person probably is very bright, right? And like that gets you pretty far like in this industry, right? So those are like people to pay attention to and people to help and people to support, right? And so, you know, I think those are like really interesting parts of being in this industry. It's one of the reasons why I started doing angel investing and things like that, because I know I can only work at one company at a time. So I'm making like one primary bet, right, in my career.
Right.
But also like I look at investing and advising as a way for me to be part of, you know, a small part of the journeys of lots of other companies that I think could be really like powerful and impactful too. And that's kind of like, you know, extending your reach within this ecosystem as a whole.
Yeah. And I mean, we definitely live in this like networks breeds networks type of world. And obviously when you first started, you had to break in, but can you just like expand a little bit more about like what the network has meant to you? Because I do think even going back to you saying, hey, I'm going to go to that barbecue, or, you know, I'm going to go to these different functions that are happening in Palo Alto during a very special time in Palo Alto. But just the importance of building that and committing to that, because I do feel like a lot of folks right now are still stuck in this like Zoom world of thinking that is networking when like in reality, like networking is very different. It's meeting people at a barbecue. It's not a 30-minute call where like follow up just doesn't mean the same thing.
It's hard because like I think the best way to do it is to not think about it as networking, right? Because then you're like, this is just like, these are just human interactions and us like getting to know other people who are really smart and interesting, right? And so if you just think about it that way, like it comes off as like not being as like skeezy, right? Yeah. Of like trying to like network my way to the top, right? Like it's like less about that and more about just like, who are the people that you want to be around, right? Like what's that saying of like, you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with or something like that, right? And so for me, it's much more about that. Like, who do you want to be spending time with? Like, who do you want to be learning from? Right. And so much of that experience is in like who you build these relationships with. And, you know, the easy thing is like the people that you work with day to day at whatever company you're at. Right. You know, and I still even look back at my time at Stripe and I'm just like, oh, I could have gotten to know more people. Right. Yeah. Like, or why didn't I get to know that person? You know, and it's just like sometimes, you know, you're moving so fast and, you know, you don't have time for it as you're at a scaling company. But there were also like a ton of people I got to know who were in like entirely different functions than I was in, had no relation to my work, but were just like great people in like building these companies. And I still like stay in touch with to this day. Totally. And also that happens at like different parts in the journey. And then, you know, you want to think about like, how do I get to carry on in my relationships with these people over time? So, at Stripe, I was there for several years, and then we eventually brought in a new COO, Claire Hughes Johnson, into the company. And I never like formally worked for her. I was always working for other leaders in the company. And she also brought a lot to the table that I like really admired in terms of like how she worked with the founders and the other company leaders and how she was like a complement to the team that already existed. And And then when I was thinking about taking this role at Linear, I was like, well, this is a COO job. I should talk to Claire, right? And like, you know, I'm like, I wonder what Claire, you know, would be doing now in trying to assess, is this the right job? Is this the right company? Are these the right founders to work with? And so I spent time with her just to understand, like, what am I missing? Like, what should I be asking? Like, you know, kind of all those things. And then after I joined Linear, we were raising money. Our Series B. And I asked the founders, I was like, hey, like, I would love for an excuse to like be able to bug Claire Hughes Johnson kind of whenever I want. So do we think we could ask her if she wants to invest in this next stage of the company? And so, you know, she angel invested in Linear as well. And so now I get to bug her, you know, whenever I like. And so
you got it.
Yeah. So things like that to me are, you know, it's, you know, what are you giving? And also like, what are you receiving? And how are you building these relationships over time? And, you know, even though I never like formally worked for her, like there are always like a lot of people who you think are like amazing at what they do. And, you know, kind of staying in touch with those people is important.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. I want to go back because I had a question earlier, and I think it actually connects to where we are now of when you first got into the workforce. I can tell in these roles you had, you didn't have a specific title. I could tell you had to basically create your title every single time, but now you're a COO. And I'm curious, can you just kind of take us through the journey of one, you landing these jobs where you might not have a specific title, but you had to kind of create it and fall into a specific place to own a responsibility. And then you understanding that your superpower is in the COO role.
I always thought of myself as like a generalist. So to your point of like not having a title, it's just kind of like, I do whatever needs to be done, right? And I think that a lot of that came from the first company, the first startup I was ever at, Pulse, where I was the first, you know, employee. And so I was doing everything on the business side that we didn't have any owner for, right? And so all those things kind of became my job. And then I picked kind of some random like business development title or something and, you know, ended up hiring people to do the jobs that I didn't necessarily want to do and, you know, all those things. And so, but in my mind, I was still very much this generalist. And then when I moved over to Stripe, I was in partnerships formally. And in that time, I did so many other things beyond that. But, you know, I didn't really care that it wasn't like reflected in my title. It's like, well, yeah, you do marketing when you don't have any marketing people, like, you know, so it's obvious to be like, hey, I think we should be, you know, responding in this like conversation that's happening about Stripe on Twitter. And so like, I'm going to be the company representative and like responding, you know, to this and, you know, that kind of stuff. I think I just picked up because it like, I saw it was a job that needed to be done and I went and I did the job. Right. And I think like that, like high agency, aspect of working at a startup is really important. And it's something I seek out in people. Like, you know, you're not looking around for someone whose job it is to do this thing. You go and do the thing. Right. And, I think that's really important. And so when I was at Stripe, I eventually took on a bunch of other jobs, like in addition to my core job. So it, like at the same time that I was doing partnerships, it's like I was head of diversity and inclusion. I managed a partner engineering team, just kind of did a bunch of random stuff. And then I had always kind of made this push to say, hey, like if there's ever a role that's kind of like a GM type role, which was very common, like at Amazon, I feel like more of like they pioneered more of that structure. I would really like that job. And so for 2 years, I was basically like, are we going to have GMs anytime soon? That would be really fun. Like I would love to run a business unit. And I think I had done enough in my career at that point that, you know, eventually once we did kind of create that role at Stripe, we called it like business lead. I was one of the first three people who was in that kind of role. And that was probably like my most exciting like career moment to be in a role where I'm like managing engineering, product, operations, everything related to the business unit. And was really exciting to me. And I was able to build a team completely from scratch as well. Yeah. So all that stuff, I think, was probably the first time where I had a role that kind of maybe made like a title that kind of made sense for what I was doing. And, you know, it's kind of like just general management. But I think at Stripe, one of the things that we always really appreciated was that you're not just a leader. You're not like someone who's just directing people. Like you are, like you need to be in the details. And that was really important for leaders at the company. And so when I was thinking about my first role outside of Stripe, which was Notion, you know, I was kind of like, okay, like I can do partnerships, I can do platform and be on the product side. And then I took on a bunch of different things while I was there. I helped hire our first head of people. You know, I, you know, led self-serve growth for a period of time when I was like, hey, someone needs to do this. And, you know, I was like, I guess it's going to be me. I hired our first PM. So I did a bunch of things that like I was not hired to do. And once I did all those things, I kind of got to a point where I realized, hey, like maybe I should have a job that is a job where that is my job, like
versus which is COO,
versus just being a job that I'm kind of taking on, you know, for fun and because of company need. And so when I was thinking about, you know, taking on another like startup leadership role, and the opportunity to have some conversations with the folks at Linear came up, it was like kind of my opportunity to say, hey, I've kind of been doing this for a while, but not formally, not with the title, right? Mm-hmm. And it's probably time to take a role where the title kind of matches the responsibility.
Mm-hmm. And well, and I like that you had that, that you did that, because I think sometimes people think they have to have the title before they get the job. I've always found that confusing, right? Like, oh, I won't apply for this COO. Never been one. It's like, yeah, well, you, Christina, literally like built the blocks for you to be COO, like you, what you just shared, right? You totally created that momentum for yourself. And I think that kind of aligns with like, you know, build towards the job that you really want, not just like the one that you have.
Right.
And so for you to actually create your own and do that is so smart.
Yeah.
And not everyone thinks like that, right? Everyone, sometimes we think a little, this is why this is FinTech Mavericks. All right. We're looking for people thinking outside the box, right? Like not to, you know, and so, and then, but now you're at Linear and you really are scaling a company that has this like cult favorite product, something that you're pretty used to, I guess, at this point, right? Between like Stripe and Notion, right? And Notion, I'm sure at the time when you were there, maybe not so much, but now it really has become, right, such a beloved product. Maybe what do you think people misunderstand about organic growth and actually creating a product that people really love? Like, I'd love to hear how do people actually kind of do that, but maybe just start with what is a big misconception around how do you actually make that happen?
Yeah. I mean, I think like it always kind of has to be there in the DNA of the founding team. So, you know, I would love to say like, oh yeah, it was me. Like I helped do that. But also like the reality is like there was something inherent with the founding team that helped make this happen. Maybe at like a small scale that you wouldn't necessarily be able to obviously recognize on the outside, but like it clearly existed. And I think a lot of it is the willingness for founders to think about what does it take to build a really strong brand and how are you going to do that from like an early stage. And every company does it very differently, right? For Stripe, it was the founders taking other YC companies really seriously and, you know, spending time with them to help them with their integrations with Stripe and all that stuff that, you know, like, why would I spend time with a company of two people? Other companies would be like, just read the API docs, like, you know, figure it out. And instead you're like taking a lot of time and attention with these customers to help make sure that they know how to use the product. And so they then become evangelists for your product. And then, you know, you find yourself, you would see the founders like commenting in Hacker News threads about like the product or where they needed help or things like that. They were very like out there and available. And so that was like the way to do it in, you know, 2012, I suppose. The way that you would do it now is very different. With Notion, for example, it was about building this like ambassador community of people who were building like Notion templates and Notion consulting businesses and just really loved the product. And those were like consumer-y in some ways and also more B2B in others. And just like taking advantage of these, it was like strong interest in what the company was doing and pulling that through into this like go-to-market flywheel, which was really interesting. And then for Linear, you know, it started with like the founders being able to build a lot of like early hype for the product around just like themselves and the problems they had faced being developers and not having a tool that they love to use. And then, you know, building a wait list around the product and, you know, really kind of building that anticipation for when you're going to get access to Linear and get off the wait list. Yeah. Right. So like they clearly were very thoughtful like about those things. And so one of the things I look back on is like, I've always picked companies that tend to have really strong brands. And sometimes those brands tend to, be further along than like the business is, right? And so, you know, I always say, even with Linear today, I feel like we punch above our weight when it comes to brand. And I think it's because, you know, we really care about what people say about our product and we take it really seriously. And like when you report a bug, we, you know, try to fix it as quickly as possible and we update you and, you know, like that usually just doesn't happen. Like if I report a bug with other products, it's like, okay, thank you for reporting that. And like, I never hear back. And like, maybe in a few weeks it'll be fixed or not, you know, but like you're building that like human connection and like personal touch. And this was, you know, something that we cared about really early on. So it's like, you have to really care. And so that has to exist with the founding team. And then hopefully I can come in as a leader and like help amplify like what already exists.
Yeah, no, I think it's giving like the almost like the Disney effect, right? In terms of experiences is really what you're talking about, right? Like you build a strong brand, but ultimately people hang out because they're getting some sort of experience that really resonates with them, right? And makes them obsessed more, and then they continue on, and then they eventually kind of exactly become evangelists for this brand and this thing, and then they're obsessed with it. But right, it's like it's funny, I had like a Sarah Levy, who's the CEO of Betterment now, but she started her career at Disney and then was CEO of Nickelodeon and Viacom, blah blah blah, amazing woman anyways. But she started at Disney, and she told me how like when you work at Disney, right, it's like not a piece of trash is on the floor at any of their amusement parks, right? You know, you never know, you never see the characters outside of their costumes, right? You'll never have a moment where you run into Cinderella and she's actually a, you know, a regular girl, right? You're never going to have that moment because they never want to break the third wall of that experience and create that alternative universe for their people to go into. And I feel like as you're sharing that, that to me is what you've created and ultimately seen in strong brands. You know, you're taking these very D2C elements and bringing it to a tech company. And it's been cool to see that like that transformation happen over time as more people rely on tech just as much as they love Disney.
Yeah. Right? Think about this as like, yeah, you're right. Like there is a consumer, like there's a belief that like this is all, it's like consumer-y in a way. And, you know, Stripe, Notion, Linear, all B2B companies. And Notion probably with the most like consumer-y play of all three. But in general, I feel like they were all companies that said, hey, like we want to really pay attention to our customer and what they care about. And at the same time, like build a customer experience that is also as strong as the product experience, right? So, you know, there's a belief sometimes when you are in tech that like you just build this amazing product and like the people come and they use the product and self-serve and like we never have to interact with each other, right? You know, Linear started right before COVID, so we had never even like met any of our customers like in person when I joined. And I was like, we should do a customer dinner. And it was like, in person, you know, like, you know, things like that. And we were just in Copenhagen for all company offsite. And we had a bunch of customers coming to one of the events that we threw. And we were meeting a bunch of our customers in Europe after that. And it's just like, you know, it's like, yes, we're growing up. People want to, people don't just buy software. They buy software from human beings, and those human beings are people that you want to bet on, you know? So when I think about like a person on our sales team, it's like, you know, they want to buy this product because ideally they like the product, but they also want to see that salesperson succeed. Right. And I think that's a really important element of the experience. Like our support team gets back to people so fast that people reply being like, are you AI? Like, you know, in the responses. And it's like, how do you respond to this if you are truly not AI? Like, it's like awkward to be like, no, you know.
I know.
Like, it's like weird, but, you know, it's like, no, one of the things we care about is that we get back to people quickly so that you can get back to like what you care about, which is like working on what you're building. And so, you know, thinking about how does this like come through to many different components of like what you're building, it's not just the product, it's like the support experience, it's how you interact with sales, like all of those things, we want it to feel like a certain way. And being very intentional about how it feels is important. Like, our founders don't want to talk to salespeople. So like when they buy products, like salespeople are pinging them. They're just like, get out of my inbox. Like this is, you know, like very classic, like engineer, don't want to talk to people type of thing. Right. And then you realize like, actually those are a lot of our customers. Like our customers don't want to talk to people. Right. And you know, what are the workflows that were where you can like help them without actually having to get on a phone call because they don't want to get on a phone call. Right. So you have to think about also different kinds of customers want different things and they want them packaged in different ways.
It's all about the surprise and delight.
That's right. The unreasonable hospitality. I keep thinking about the Instagram where they always say like they're showing a picture of someone screaming and it's them saying operator because they just want to like bypass the tone of the airline that's trying to help them out with customer service. But like you're 100% right. A big part of my early career was I was an AE. And anybody that's been an AE or an SDR, like they know what it's like just trying to get in front of someone just to convince them that like what you're selling is worth their time. And we're living in this new world now where we have access to quick builds around AI and different technology to make it so the in-person or the over the phone or the conversational experience can be so much more delightful. And so I am curious, and this jumps into a couple of different places because Christina, we spoke while it was in between, I think your move from Notion to Linear, and you were at, I believe, First Round for a second, trying to kind of figure out what was next. And you were investing. Like you were leaning in, you were looking for new companies to invest in. And I'm curious, as you are looking at the space that we're in right now, with AI, with vibe coding, with all the different ways to scale quick turnkey businesses faster, build wrappers, brand wrappers around businesses. Like, what are the trends that you're seeing right now? What excites you? What do you hate? What's hype? What's overhyped? Tell me everything.
Yeah. Oh, I feel like the question I always have when I look at businesses now, and it's even changed from when I was an investor 2 years ago, right? Is like, what here is durable? Like what here is going to stand the test of time? Because, okay, yes, you might be building something really cool with AI, but like, is OpenAI or Anthropic going to build that tomorrow? And like, what advantage do you have over them, right? Very obvious question that's existed for many years with like platforms, right? And you know, how powerful they can ultimately become. But also like, are people just like trying your product out just for fun to like build something really cool? And then do they churn, right? Like, what does your retention look like, right? Are people sticking around for the product? Like, what is the evolution of the product look like, right? And I think the more that you are just like a super thin, you know, wrapper around maybe some kind of LLM out there, the harder it will be for your business to exist because people will get super comfortable with using tools like ChatGPT and Claude and others to just like prompt, you know, the way they do for everything else. Like you're going to start like taking pictures of what's in your refrigerator and saying like, give me a recipe. Right. And so if you're using it on a day-to-day basis as a consumer, like in the B2B world, you're also going to start using the product incredibly heavily. And so if a product isn't significantly better, a significant step above just using a chat interface with the prominent LLM providers these days, it's going to be really hard to like succeed. Right. So I think people who are bringing AI into the tools and using them in a really like unique way are probably going to be the people who succeed the most. Right. Versus people who are just like, oh, like we're, you know, this for that. You know, and like making, you know, a slightly better version that's like tailored to this use case, you know, versus what already exists today. So I think you have to be thinking more about like workflow products and tools and how AI can really come in and like be helpful there versus just entirely building off of, you know, someone else's stack and seeing where it goes. Because you're also starting to see this, that like a lot of the major providers today out there in terms of LLMs are just, you know, looking at who's building on top of their platform, what's really successful, and what can we duplicate with a team of like 20 engineers tomorrow?
That's right.
So, you know, and I think they're doing it way faster than you see with other companies. Like if you think about, like so many people said this about Facebook, for example, right? Like, oh, you're going to build this tool off of Facebook and you'll pull in all of your Facebook friends, you know, Instagram, for example, right? But, you know, they'll just figure out that you're doing this and cut off access and then, you know, Instagram will be no more, right? And it took forever for companies like Facebook to like build like their equivalent of like stories on Instagram to compete with Snapchat or like, you know, things like that, right? And now I think you're just seeing the pace pick up like crazy, where you don't have like a year until someone else catches up.
That's right.
Like you could have launched your product and then 3 or 4 months later, some company can duplicate it, right? And that's because there are all these tools that make it so much easier for them to like build faster. And also these people are like not sleeping. Like these AI companies, they're working like 6 days a week minimum, going into the office. It's very different from how it used to be. And I think that's because more than anything else, the thing that matters most in this space is like speed and velocity.
That's right.
More so than like other things. And so you're starting to see that like, I think for a lot of these companies, it's, you know, you don't have the lead time that you used to when you would build like a unique product for the first time. And it's much more easy to like replicate it. That said, I would say that like companies that really care and think about products in terms of like craft and like building the right tools, like those companies tend to stand out right now, just because a lot of what is being built is kind of crappy, right? It's like, oh, totally. You built this with some random vibe coding tool or something like that. And it works, but you know, it's like not built. Built with like, the right level of care and those things. And that's because those things are hard. That's what takes time.
Yep.
Right. So if you are able to do that at a fast enough pace, like I think you are probably more likely to ultimately succeed.
Cool. And I know we're about to jump into some fast questions here, but I want to just start it off. I'm going to say one and then Nicole, please jump in with yours. But Christina, if you went back into the VC space tomorrow and you had to lead investing with AI at the intersection of what industry would you want to be leading?
Oh, AI at the top of like a traditional industry or something like that.
Healthcare, whatever. Like, yeah, it could be anything at the AI at the intersection of any industry.
Developer tools.
That fits you. I get that.
Drew's like, great.
Fun three.
Good to know. That was a good one. Okay, yes. Rapid fire. That was a part of it. One question for me. So what are the three, I'm gonna say, what are the top three green flags that make a company a winner?
If I'm thinking about it as like companies to join, I would say like founders who actually care about their people, like one green flag. High growth rate. So that could be like in terms of like users or revenue, month over month. And revenue retention or like customer retention.
One piece of career advice you wish you'd ignored.
I feel like I don't regret anything because it's worked out pretty well for me.
I was about to say, I feel like I love that. Actually, after I said that question out loud, I was like, she ignored the traditional way.
It was worth a shot. It was worth a shot with that question. I like that.
I worked with people for 7 weeks. I tried it, didn't work out.
She's like, I have no regrets.
Yeah.
Period. Okay. A song that always gets you in the zone.
I can't really listen to songs and do real work, honestly. I have to be kind of in silence. Yeah. So if I'm like running or exercising, like yes to songs. But yeah, otherwise like I kind of need to be, I can't kind of, you know, silence.
No regrets. Silence. Okay. No, and silence. This is good. I like it. Very, it's different. Okay. Your go-to ritual when everything feels chaotic.
A walk. Yeah. Just like a walk outside 30 minutes.
Yeah. They call those hot girl walks.
Yes. Right.
on the internet.
I've heard. Yeah.
I've seen them. Drew takes his hot girl walks. I think he takes them
all
around
day
his office.
Long. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, Drew, finish us out.
Cool. The boldest move you made in your career?
I'd probably say leaving what I felt was like a really great like role when I was at Stripe and going to Notion. And like, you know, after 7.5 years, just like leaving a place after a really long time is hard. But I think, you know, ultimately it got me to where I am now. So yeah.
Awesome. One thing founders often get wrong about partnerships.
I think not putting themselves in the partner's shoes and thinking about like, why would this company do this? And why is it the best move for them? Because I think anything you're trying to sell has to come across that way to the other side.
Love it. Your most unpopular opinion about startup culture?
Maybe just you do have to work really hard. I think there was like a period of time where people were like, work like 2 hours, like work-life balance and things like that. And I was just like, I mean, not if you really want to win. Like there has to be, you know, like there has to be some urgency, right? And we have to like move fast and we've got to work hard, especially, you know, and I think about this differently also now at my age, because what got me to where I am was like working really long hours and working really hard. Because when I didn't have connections, when I didn't have a network, when I didn't have experience, that was the only thing that made me stand out, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas actually now in my career that I have all those things that I didn't have then, I can work less.
That's it.
I have all these things that get me further faster than like all I had on my side was hard work. So I would say from like a young person's and early career person's perspective, like working hard and the hours you put in does make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
My dad used to always say, every day is a resume builder.
Every day. Okay, last question here. Finish the sentence. The best founders always
grow. And I think that's both like personally, like as human beings and evolve, and the business, grow the business also. Yeah.
Love. Love. Yeah,
well said. Absolutely well said. Christina, thank you so much for joining us on FinTech Mavericks and for sharing your story, proving that you don't have to follow any rules or the script to build something remarkable, and also for sharing your secrets around how to build a cult-like product. We are, all three of us, we're working on all of ours. Yes. So this is very helpful.
Appreciate you, Christina.
Yeah. No, thank you so much for joining.
You're the best. Thank you.